She smiled. It's dangerous to call a warlock names like that, Simon. But, yes, I tried. I looked for Tobias Arendelle, using ways the Nephilim do not have access to, and found him wandering mad in the forest, not even knowing his own name. She lowered her head. I couldn't save him or Eva. But I saved the baby. I managed that much.
But how? Where?
I used a certain amount of magic and cunning to make my way into the prison of the Shadow Hunters, where you were held once, said Katerina, nodding to him. I made the baby come early, and cast a spell to make it seem as if she was still carrying the child. Eva was still that night, relentless and bright in the darkness that had come upon her. She did not falter, and she did not flinch, and she did not betray herself by any sign as she walked to meet her death. She kept her a secret to the very end, and the Shadow Hunters who killed her never suspected a thing. After that, it was almost easy. The Nephilim seldom have any interest in the doings of downworlders, and downworlders often find their blindness very convenient. They never noticed when I sailed away to the new world with a baby. I stayed there for 20 years before I went back to my people and my work, and raised the child until he was grown. He has been dust for years, but I can close my eyes and see his face when he was as young as you are now. Tobias and Eva's child. He was a sweet boy, kind as his father, and fierce as his mother. The Nephilim believe in living by hard laws and paying high prices, but their arrogance means they do not fully understand the cost of what they do. The world would have been poorer without that boy in it. He had a mundane love, and a mundane life filled with small acts of grace, which would have meant very little to a Shadow Hunter. They did not deserve him. I left him as a gift to the mundane world.
So, you're saying there's another Herondale out there somewhere? Maybe generations of Herondales that no one knows anything about?
There was a line from the Talmud Simon's father had always liked to quote. He who saves a single life, it is as if he has saved an entire world.
It's possible, Katerina said. I made sure the boy never knew what he was. It was safest that way. If indeed his line lives on, his descendants surely believe themselves mundane. It's only now, with the Shadow Hunters so depleted, that the Clave might welcome their lost sons or daughters back to the fold. And perhaps there are those of us who might help that along. Then the time is ripe.
Why are you telling me this, Miss Loss? Why now? Why ever?
She stopped walking and turned to him, silver-white hair billowing in the wind.
Saving that child. That's the biggest crime I've ever committed. At least, according to Shadow Hunter law.
If anyone knew. Even now.
She shook her head.
But it's also the bravest choice I've ever made. The one I'm most proud of. I'm bound by the Accords just like everyone else, Simon. I do my best to live by the rule of law. But I make my own decisions. There's always a higher law.
You say that like it's so easy to know what it is, Simon said. To be so sure of yourself, that you're right no matter what the law says.
It's not easy, Katerina corrected him. It's what it means to be alive. Remember what I said, Simon. Every decision you make makes you. Never let other people choose who you are going to be.
When he returned to his room, his mind spinning, George was sitting on the ground in the hallway studying his codex.
George?
Simon peered down at his roommate.
Wouldn't it be easier to do that inside where there's light and no disgusting slime on the ground?
Well, he sighed. Less slime, at least.
She said I'll have to wait out here, George said, that you two need your privacy.
Who said?
But the question was superfluous, Because who else? Before George could answer, he was already opening the door and charging inside.
Isabel, you can't just throw my roommate.
He stopped short, so suddenly that he nearly tripped over himself.
It's not Isabel, said the girl perched on his bed.
Her fire-red hair was pulled into a messy bun and her legs were folded beneath her. She looked utterly at home, as if she'd spent half her life lounging around in his bed. Which, according to her, she had.
What are you doing here, Clary?
I portaled in, she said. He nodded, waiting. He was glad to see her, but it also hurt, just as it always did. He wondered when the pain would go and he would be able to feel the joy of friendship that he knew was still there, like a plant under frozen ground, waiting to grow again.
I heard what happened today, with the vampire and Isabel.
Simon lowered himself onto George's bed, across from her.
I'm fine, okay? No bite marks or anything. It's nice of you to worry about me, but you can't just portal in and...
Clary snorted.
I can see your ego's unharmed. I'm not here because I'm worried about you, Simon.
Oh, then...
I'm worried about Isabel.
I'm pretty sure Isabel can take care of herself.
You don't know her, Simon. I mean, not anymore. And if she knew I was here, she'd murder me, but... Can you just try to be a little nicer to her, please?
Simon was appalled. He knew that he disappointed Isabel, that his very existence was a constant disappointment to her, that she wanted him to be someone else. But it had never occurred to him that he, the non-vampire, non-heroic, non-sexy iteration of Simon Lewis, could have the power to hurt her.
I'm sorry, he blurted. Tell her I'm sorry. Are you kidding me? Clary said. Did you not hear the part about how she'd murder me if she knew I was talking to you about this? I'm not telling her anything. I'm telling you. Be careful with her. She's more fragile than she seems.
She seems like the strongest girl I've ever met, Simon said.
She's that, too, Clary allowed.
She shifted uncomfortably then, and hopped to her feet.
Well, I should... I mean, I know you don't really want me around here, so...
It's not that, I just...
No, I get it, but... I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
They both laughed, and Simon felt something loosening in his chest. A muscle he hadn't even known was clenched.
It didn't used to be like this, huh?
He asked.
Awkward. No.
She gave him a sad smile.
It was a lot of things. But it was never awkward.
He couldn't imagine it, feeling so at ease with a girl, much less a girl like her, pretty and confident and so filled with light.
I bet I like that.
I hope so, Simon. Clary. He didn't want her to leave. Not yet. But he wasn't sure what to say to her if she stayed.
Do you know the story of Tobias Arendelle?
Everyone knows that story, she said. And, obviously, because of Jace. Simon blinked, remembering. Jace was a Herondale. The last of the Herondales. Or so he thought. If he had family out there, lost for generations, he would want to know, wouldn't he? Was Simon supposed to tell him? Tell Clary? He imagined a lost Herondale out there, some golden-eyed girl or boy who didn't know anything about the Shadow Hunters or their sordid legacy. Maybe they would welcome finding out who they really were, but maybe, if Clary and Jace came knocking at their door, telling them stories of angels and demons and a noble tradition of death-defying insanity, they would run screaming in the opposite direction. Sometimes, Simon wondered what would have happened if Magnus had never found him, never offered him the chance to re-enter the Shadowhunter world. He would have been living a lie, sure, but it would have been a happy lie. He would have gone to college, kept playing with his band, flirted with some non-terrifying girls, lived on the surface of things, never guessing at the darkness that lay beneath. He guessed that in his other life, telling Clary what he knew wouldn't even have been a question. He guessed that they were the kind of friends who told each other everything. They weren't any kind of friends now, he reminded himself. She was a stranger who loved him. But she was still a stranger.
What do you think of it? He asked her. What the Clave did to Tobias's wife and child.
What do you think I think? Clary asked. Given who my father was? Given what happened to Jace's parents and how he survived it? Isn't it obvious?
It may have been obvious to someone who knew them and their stories, but not to Simon. Her face fell.
Oh.
His confusion must have been visible, as was her disappointment, like she was remembering all over again who he was and who he wasn't.
It doesn't matter. Let's just say that I do think the law matters, but it's not the only thing that matters. I mean, if we followed the law without thinking, would you and I ever have...
What?
She shook her head. No, I promised myself I wasn't going to keep doing this. You don't need a bunch of stories about what happened to us, who you used to be. You have to figure out who you are now, Simon. I want that for you. That freedom.
It amazed him how well she understood, how she knew what he wanted without him having to ask. It gave him the nerve to ask her something he'd been wondering ever since he got to the academy. Clary, back when we were friends, before you knew about shadow hunting or anything, were you and I the same?
The same how?
He shrugged. You know, into weird music and comics and, like, really not into gym.
You mean, were we both klutzy nerds?
Clary asking, laughing again.
That's affirmative.
But now you're... He waved a hand at her, indicating the taut biceps, the graceful, coordinated way she moved, everything he knew of her past and present. You're like this Amazon warrior.
Thanks, I think.
Jace is a good trainer. And, you know, there was incentive to get up to speed pretty quick, fending off the apocalypse and all, twice.
Right.
And I guess it's in your blood. I mean, it makes sense that you'd be good at all this stuff.
Simon.
She narrowed her eyes, suddenly seeming to understand what he was getting at.
You do realize shadow hunting isn't just about how big your muscles are, right? They don't call it bodybuilding academy.
He rubbed his aching biceps ruefully.
Maybe they should. Simon, you wouldn't be here if the people in charge didn't think you had what it takes.
They think he had what it takes, Simon corrected her. The guy with the vampy super strength and whatever else it is vampires bring to the table.
Clary got close enough to poke him in the chest. And then she did. Hard. No. You. Simon, do you know how we got as far as we did in that demon dimension? How we managed to get ourselves close enough to Sebastian to take him down?
No, but I'm guessing it involved a lot of demon killing, Simon asked.
Not as much as there might have been, because you came up with a better strategy, Clary said. Something you figured out from all those years playing D&D.
Wait, seriously? Are you telling me that stuff actually worked in real life?
I'm telling you that. I'm telling you that you saved us, Simon. You did it more than once. Not because you were a vampire, not because of anything you've lost. Because of who you were. Who you still are.
She stepped away then and took a deep breath.
I promised myself I wouldn't do this, she said fiercely. I promised.
No, he said. I'm glad you did. I'm glad you came.
I should get out of here, Clary said. But try to remember about Izzy, okay? I know you can't understand this, but every time you look at her like she's a stranger, it's like... It's like someone pressing a hot iron to her flesh. It hurts that much. She sounded so certain, like she knew. Like maybe they weren't just talking about Isabel anymore. Simon felt it then. Not the twinge of fondness he often experienced when Clary smiled at him, but a forceful rush of love that nearly swept him off his feet and into her arms. For the first time, he looked at her, and she wasn't a stranger. She was Clary, his friend, his family, the girl he'd sworn always to protect, the girl he loved as fiercely as he loved himself. "Clary," he said. "When we were friends, it was great, right? I mean, I'm not just imagining things, feeling like this is where we belong. We got each other. We supported each other. We were good together, right?" Her smile turned from sad to something else, something that glowed with the same certainty that he felt, that there was something real between them. It was as if he'd switched on a light inside her. "Oh, Simon," she said. "We were absolutely amazing."
The Whitechapel Fiend. Read by Luke Pasqualino.
"I spy," George said, "with my little eye, something that begins with S." "It's slime, isn't it?" Simon said. He was lying on his back in the cot in his dorm room. His roommate, George, was lying on the opposite cot. Both of them were staring up thoughtfully into the darkness, which involved staring at the ceiling, which was unfortunate because the ceiling was gross.
"It's always slime."
"Not so," George said. "One time it was mold." "I'm not sure we can really make the distinction between slime and mold, and I hate that I have to care about that." "It wasn't slime anyway." Simon considered for a moment. "Is it a snake? Please tell me it's not a snake." He curled up his legs involuntarily. "It's not a snake, but now that's all I'll be able to think about. Are there snakes in Idris? It seems like the kind of place where they drive the snakes out."
"Isn't that Ireland?" Simon said.
"I don't think there are limitations on snake driving. Surely they got rid of the snakes. Must have done." "Oh, God. This place has to have snakes." There was a faint tremor to George's soft Scottish burr now.
"Are there raccoons here in Idris?"
Simon said, trying to change the subject. He adjusted himself on the hard, narrow bed. There was no point in adjusting. Every position was just as uncomfortable as the last.
"We have raccoons in New York. They can get in anywhere. They can open doors. I read online that they even know how to use keys."
"I don't like snakes. Snakes don't need keys." Simon paused for a moment to recognize the fact that "Snakes Don't Need Keys" was a good album name. It sounded deep for a second, but then completely shallow and obvious, which made you go back to the first thought and think it might be deep.
"So what was it?" Simon asked.
"What was what? What did you spy that begins with S?"
"Simon."
This was the kind of game you played when you lived in a sparsely decorated room located in the basement of the Shadowhunter Academy, or, as they had started to refer to it, the floor of ultimate moisture. George had commented many times on how it was a shame they weren't slugs, because it was perfectly set up for the slug lifestyle. They had come to an uneasy acceptance of the fact that many creatures had made the academy their home after it was closed down. They no longer panicked when they heard skittering noises in the wall or under the bed. If the noises were in the bed, they allowed themselves some panic. This had happened more than once. In theory, the mundanes, or dregs as they were sometimes often called, were down in the basement because it was the most secure floor. Simon was sure there was probably some truth to that. But there was probably a lot more truth to the fact that the shadow hunters tended to have a natural snobbery that ran in the blood. But Simon had asked to be here, both with the dregs and in the Shadowhunter Academy itself, so there was no point in complaining. With no Wi-Fi, no phones, no television, nights could be long. Once the lights went out, Simon and George often talked to each other across the darkness like this. Sometimes they lay in their respective beds in a companionable silence, each knowing the other was there. It was something. It was everything, really, just to have George in the room. Simon wasn't sure if he would be able to bear it otherwise. And it wasn't just the cold or the rats or anything else about the place physically. It was what was in his head, the ever-increasing noises, slices of memories. They came to him like bits of forgotten songs, tunes he couldn't place. There were remembrances of tremendous joys and fears, but he couldn't often connect them to the events of people. They were just feelings, batting him around in the dark. "Do you ever notice," George said, "how even the blankets feel wet when you know they're dry? And I come from Scotland, I know wool. I know sheep, but this wool, there's something demonic about this wool. I cut my knuckles on it making the bed the other morning." Simon hummed a reply. There was no need for any real attention. He and George had these same conversations every night. The slime and the mould and the creatures in the walls and the rough blankets and the cold. Every night these were the topics. Simon's thoughts drifted. He had two visitors recently, and neither of the visits had gone well. Isabel and Clary, two of the most important people in his life as far as he could tell, had both come to the academy. Isabel had appeared to stake her claim on Simon, and Simon, in a move that astonished him still, told her to back off. He couldn't just go back to the way it was. Not like this. Not when he couldn't remember what it was. And then, in the training exercise, Isabel had shown up and slain a vampire that was about to take Simon down. But she had done so coolly. There was a distressing deadness to the way she spoke. Then Clary had popped up. "Be careful with her," Clary had said. "She's more fragile than she seems." Isabel, with her whip and her ability to slice a demon in half, was more fragile than she seemed. The guilt had been keeping him awake at night. "Isabel again?" George asked.
"How did you know?"
"Educated guess. I mean, she showed up and threatened to cut anyone to ribbons who got near you, and now you don't seem to be talking. And your friend Clary showed up to talk to you about her. And you also mumble her name when you sleep."
"I do?
On occasion. You're either saying Isabel or fishy smell. Could be either, to be fair." "How do I fix this?" Simon asked. "I don't even know what I'm fixing."
"I don't know," George said. "But morning comes early. Best way to sleep."
There was a long pause, and then... "There must be snakes," George said. "Isn't this place everything a snake could want? Cool, made of stone, lots of holes to slither in and out of. Lots of mice to eat. Why am I still talking? Simon, make me stop talking." But Simon let him go on. Even talk of possible nearby snakes was better than what was going through his head. Idris did its seasons properly in general. It was like New York in that manner. You got each one distinct and clear. But Idris was more pleasant than New York. The winter wasn't just frozen garbage and slush. The summer wasn't just boiling garbage and air conditioner drippings that always felt like spit coming from overhead. Idris was greenery in the warm weather, crisp and tranquil in the cold. The air always smelling of freshness and burning log fires. Mostly, there were mornings like the ones this week, which were all bluster. Winds with little fish hooks at the end of every gust. Cold that got inside the clothes. Shadow hunter gear, while practical, wasn't necessarily warm. It was light, easy to move in like fighting gear should be. It was not made for standing outside on a boggy stretch at 7 in the morning when the sun was barely up. Simon thought of his puffy jacket from home and his bed, and heating in general. Breakfast, which had been a glue substitute under the banner of porridge, sat heavily in his stomach. Coffee! That's what this morning needed. Idris had no coffee places, nowhere to pop in and get a cup of the hot, steaming and awake-making. The breakfast drink at the academy was a thin tea that Simon suspected was not tea at all, but the watery runoff of one of the many noxious soups that emerged from the back of the kitchen. He swore he'd found a bit of potato skin in his mug that morning. He hoped it was potato skin. One cup from Java Jones. Was that so much to want from life? "Do you see this tree?" shouted Delaney Scarsbury, pointing at a tree. Of the many questions their physical trainer had put to them over the last few months, this was one of the most logical and direct, and yet confusing. Everyone could clearly see the tree. It was the only tree in this particular patch of field. It was tall, slightly tilted to the left. Mornings with Scarsbury sounded like the name of a call-in radio show for cranks, but it was, in reality, just physical punishment designed to condition and train them to fight. And to be fair, Simon was more in shape now than he had been when he arrived. "Do you see this tree?" The question had been so weirdly obvious that no one had replied. Now they all mumbled a yes, they saw the tree. "Here is what you're going to do," Scarsby said. "You're going to climb this tree, walk along that branch." He pointed to one heavy main branch. "Maybe 15 feet from the ground?" "And jump off."
"No, I'm not," Simon muttered.
Similar sounds of discontent rumbled around the class. No one seemed excited about the prospect of climbing up a tree and then deliberately falling out of it.
"Morning," said a familiar voice.
Simon turned to see Jace Herondale behind him, all smiles. He looked relaxed and rested and utterly comfortable in his gear. Shadowhunters could draw runes for warmth. They didn't need hypoallergenic, down substitute puffy coats. Jace wasn't wearing a hat either, which allowed his perfectly tussled golden hair to wave attractively in the breeze. He was keeping back and had not yet been noticed by the others, who were still listening to Scarsbury yelling over the wind while pointing at the tree. "How did you get roped into this?" Simon asked, blowing into his hands to warm them. Jace shrugged.
"Just lending a graceful and athletic hand," he said. "It would be remiss of me to deny the newest generation of shadow hunters a glimpse of what they could become if they were very, very, very lucky."
Simon closed his eyes for a moment.
"You're doing this to impress Clary?" he said. "Also checking up on me."
"By the angel, he's gone to Helpathic," Jace said, pretending to stagger back. "Basically, everyone's pitching in since all your teachers ran away, and I'm assisting with training, like it or not."
"Hmm,"
said Simon.
"Not."
"Come on now," Jace said, clapping him on the arm. "You used to love doing this."
"Did I?"
"Maybe," Jace said. "You didn't scream? Wait, no. Yes, you did. My mistake.
But it's easy. This is just a training exercise."
"The last training exercise involved killing a vampire. In the training exercise before that, I watched someone get an arrow in the knee."
"I've seen worse. Come on. This is a fun exercise."
"There is no fun here," Simon said. "This is not Fun Academy. I should know. I was in a band once called Fun Academy."
"To assist you this morning," Scarsbury yelled, "we have an expert and highly physically able shadow hunter, Jace Lightwood Herondale."
There was an audible gasp and titters of nervous laughter as every head turned in Jace's direction. There were suddenly a lot of female sighs from the class, and some male ones too. It reminded Simon of standing in line for a rock concert. At any moment he felt the crowd might burst into a squeeing noise most unbecoming to future demon hunters. Jace smiled wider and stepped forward to lead the group. Scarsbury nodded his greeting and stepped back, arms folded. Jace eyed the tree for a moment and then leaned casually against it.
"The trick to falling is not to fall," Jace said.
"Wonderful," Simon said under his breath.
"You are not falling. You are choosing to descend using the most direct means possible. You remain in control of your descent. A shadow hunter does not fall. A shadow hunter drops. You've been trained in the basic mechanics of how to do this."
Simon recalled Scarsbury shouting a few things over the wind a few days before that may have been training instructions on falls. Phrases like,
"avoid rocks," and "not on your back," and "unless you're a complete idiot, which some of you are."
"So now we'll take the theory and put it into practice."
Jace took hold of the tree and scampered up it with the ease of a monkey, and then made his way to the branch where he stood freely and easily.
"Now," he called down to the group, "I look at the ground. I choose my landing site. Remember, protect the head. If there's any way to break momentum, any other surface you can use to lessen the length of the fall, use it. Unless it's dangerous, don't aim for sharp rocks or branches that could pierce or break you. Bend the knees, keep relaxed. If your hands make impact, make sure to make contact with the entire palm, but avoid this. Feet down, then roll. Keep that momentum going. Spread out the force of the impact. Like so."
Jace delicately stepped off the branch and dropped to the ground, striking with a subdued thud. He instantly rolled and was up on his feet again in a moment.
"Like that,"
He gave his hair a little shake. Simon watched several people flush as he did so. Marisol had to cover her face with her hands for a moment.
Excellent, said Scarsbury. That's what you will all do. Jace will assist.
Jace took this as a cue to climb the tree again. He made it look so simple, so elegant. Just hand over hand, feet firmly gripped the entire way up. At the top, he took a casual seat in the nook of a branch, swung his legs.
Who's first?
There was no movement for a moment. Might as well get it over with, George said in a low voice, before holding up his hand and stepping forward. Though George was not as nimble as Jace, he did make it up the tree. He used a lot of clutching, and his feet slipped several times. Some of the phrases he used were lost to the wind, but Simon was pretty sure they were obscene. Once George reached the branch, Jace leaned back dangerously to make room. George considered the branch for a moment, the lone, unsupported beam stretching over the ground.
Come on, Lovelace, Scarsbury shouted.
Simon saw Jace lean in and offer a few words of advice to George, who was still gripping the trunk of the tree. Then, with Jace nodding, George released the tree and took a few careful steps out onto the branch. He hesitated again, teetering a bit in the wind. Then he looked down, and with a pained expression, he stepped off the branch and fell heavily to the ground. The thud he made was much louder than Jace's, but he did roll and managed to get back on his feet.
Not bad,
Scarsbury said as George hobbled back to Simon. He was rubbing his arm. You do not want to do that, he said to Simon as he approached. Simon had already worked that out. The confirmation didn't help his spirits. Simon watched his classmates go up the tree one by one. For some, that took up to 10 minutes of grunting and clawing and occasionally falling off halfway up.
This got a loud, I told you, not on your back, from Scarsbury.
Jay stayed in the tree the entire time, like some kind of rakish bird, at points smiling at the students below. Sometimes he looked elegantly bored and walked up and down the branch for fun. When there was simply no avoiding it anymore, Simon approached for his turn. Jay smiled at him from above.
It's easy, Jay said. You probably did it all the time as a child. Just do that.
I'm from Brooklyn, Simon replied. We don't climb trees. Jace shrugged, suggesting that these things were not to be helped. The first thing Simon learned about the tree was that while it appeared to lean to one side, it was really just straight up. And while the bark was rough and cut into the meat of the hands, it was also slippery, so every time he tried to get a foothold, he lost it. He tried to do it the way he'd seen Jace and George do it. They seemed to grip the tree very lightly. Simon tried this, realized it was futile, and grabbed the tree in a hug so intimate he wondered if they were now dating. Using this awkward clutching method and some frog-like leg pushes, he managed to get up the trunk, scraping his face along the way. About 3/4 of the way up, he felt his palms slick with sweat, and he started to lose his grip. The falling feeling filled him with a sudden panic, and he gripped harder.
You're doing fine,
Jace said, in a voice that suggested Simon was not doing fine, but that was the kind of thing Jace was supposed to say. Simon made it to the branch using a few desperate moves he knew looked very bad from below. There was almost definitely a moment or two when his butt must have been on display in a less than flattering manner. But he made it. Standing up was the next trick, which he accomplished with more fevered gripping of the trunk.
Good, Jace said, giving a quirky little smile. Now just walk to me.
Jace walked backward down the branch. Backward. Now that Simon was on the branch, it didn't look like it was 15 feet off the ground. It looked like it was in the sky. It was round and uneven and slippery as ever, and it wasn't meant to be walked on, especially not in the sneakers Simon had chosen to wear that morning. But he'd gotten this far, and he wasn't going to let Jace do his magic backward walk while he clung to the trunk. He had gotten up there. Climbing down was a bad prospect, so there was really just the one option. And at least it was quick. Simon took his first step. His body immediately began to shake.
Look up, Jay said sharply. Look at me. I need to see.
You need to look up to keep your balance. Look at me. Jay had stopped smirking. Simon looked at him.
Now step again. Don't look down. Your feet will find the branch. Arms out for balance. Don't worry about down yet. Eyes on me.
Somehow this worked. Simon made it 6 steps out onto the branch and was amazed to find himself standing there, arms rigid and out like airplane wings, the wind blowing hard, just out on a tree branch with Jace. Now, turn to face the academy. Keep looking out. Use it as a horizon. That's how you stay balanced. You choose a fixed point to concentrate on. Keep your weight forward. You don't want to go over backward. No, Simon really didn't want to do that. He moved 1 foot to meet the other, and then he was standing facing the pile of rocks that formed the academy, and his fellow students below, all looking up. Most did not look impressed, but George gave him a thumbs up. Now, Jay said, bend a bit at the knees, and then I want you to just step off in one large stepping motion. Don't jump with both feet, just step. And as you go down, bring your legs together and keep yourself relaxed. This should not have been the hardest thing he'd ever done. Simon knew he'd done more. He knew he'd fought demons and come back from the dead. Jumping out of a tree should not have felt this terrifying. He stepped into the air. He felt his brain react to this new information. There's nothing there. Don't do it. There's nothing there. But momentum had already pulled his other leg off the branch, and then... The good thing that could be said about the experience was that it was quick. Points to gravity on that one. A few seconds of almost blissful fear and confusion, and then a hammering feeling as his feet met the earth. His skeleton juddered, his knees buckled in submission, his aching skull lodged a formal complaint, and he fell over sideways in what would have been a roll if he had rolled and not, in fact, just remained there on the ground in a shrimp position.
"Get up, Lewis!"
Scarsbury yelled. Jace landed beside him, like a large killer butterfly, barely making a noise. "The first one is always the hardest," he said, offering Simon a hand. "The first few dozen, really. I can't remember." It hurt, but he didn't appear to be hurt. The wind was knocked out of his lungs, and he needed a moment to take a few deep breaths. He staggered back to where George was waiting, a sympathetic look on his face. The last 2 students completed the task, each looking as miserable as Simon. And then they were free to go for lunch. Most of the group was limping as they made their way back across the field. Since Katerina had buried the soup in the woods, the kitchens of the academy had been forced to try to come up with some other kind of foodstuff. As usual, an attempt was made to feature food from around the world, to reflect the many nations the students had come from. Today, Simon was informed, featured Swedish cuisine. There were meatballs, a vat of lingonberry sauce, mashed potatoes, smoked salmon, fish balls, beet salad, and at the very end, a very strong-smelling item that Simon was informed was a special pickled herring from the Baltic region. Simon got the sense that, prepared by people who knew what they were doing, everything on offer would have looked a lot more delicious, except possibly the pickled herring from the Baltic region. In terms of what a vegetarian can eat, there wasn't much. He got some potatoes and lingonberry sauce and scraped 1 portion's worth of beet salad out of the practically empty container. Some kind shadow hunter from Alicante had clearly taken pity on students and provided bread rolls, which were eagerly snatched up. By the time Simon limped to the basket, it was empty. He turned to make his way to a table and found Jace in his path. He had a roll in his hand and had already clearly taken a bite. "How about you sit with me?" The academy cafeteria looked less like a school dining hall and more like a terrible, cheap restaurant that had gotten its furnishings out of dumpsters. There were big tables and tiny, intimate ones. Simon, still too sore to make jokes about lunch dates, followed Jace to one of the small, rickety tables on the side of the room. He was aware of everyone watching them go. He gave George a nod, hoping to convey that he just had to do this. No offense in not sitting with him. George nodded back. John, Julie, and the others in the elite course, who had been devastated to miss falling out of trees with Jace Herondale 101, all stared over as if ready to leap up and save Jace from the bad company he'd fallen into, carry him away in a litter made of chocolate and roses, and bear his children. Once they sat, Jace tucked into his lunch and didn't say a word. Simon watched him eat and waited, but Jace was all about the food. He had taken large helpings of most things, including the pickled Baltic herring. Now that he was even closer to it, Simon began to suspect that the fish had not been pickled at all. Someone at the famed Shadowhunter Academy kitchens had attempted to pickle fish, something that took skill and precise adherence to instructions, and had probably just invented a new form of botulism. Jace shoveled it back. Then again, Jace was the sort of man-versus-wild guy who would probably be happy to fish a trout out of a stream with his bare hands and eat it while it was still flopping. "Did you want to talk to me about something?" Simon finally asked. Jace forked up a meatball and looked at Simon meditatively. "I've been doing research," he said, "into my family." "The Herondales?" Simon supplied after a short pause. "You might not remember, but I have a kind of a complicated family history," Jace said. "Anyway, I only found out I was a Herondale a little while ago. It took me a while to adjust to the idea. They're kind of a legendary family." Back to the food for a few minutes, when his plates and bowls were empty, Jace sat back and regarded Simon for a moment. Simon considered asking if Jace was kind of a big deal, but decided he wouldn't get the joke. Jace went on. "Anyway, the whole thing, it started to remind me, well, of you. It's like there are these important things in my history, but I don't know all of them. And I'm trying to pull together an identity that has all these holes in it. The Herondales, some of them were good people, and then some of them were monsters." "None of that needs to affect you," Simon said. "The choices you make are what matter, not your bloodline. But I imagine you have a lot of people in your life to tell you that. Clary, Alec." He looked at Jace sideways. "Isabel." Jace's eyebrows went up. "You want to talk about Isabel? Or Alec?" "Alec hates me, and I don't know why," Simon said. "Isabel hates me, and I do know why, which is almost worse. So, no, I don't want to talk about the Lightwoods." "It's true you have a Lightwood problem," Jace said, and his golden eyes glinted. "It started with Alec. As you astutely observed, you do have a history, but I shouldn't get in the middle of that." "Please tell me what's going on with Alec," Simon said. "You are really freaking me out." "No," Jace said. "There are so many deep feelings involved. There's so much hurt. It wouldn't be right. I didn't come here to stir up trouble. I came here to show potential shadow hunters how to drop from heights without breaking their necks." Simon stared at Jace. Jace stared back with wide, innocent golden eyes. Simon decided that the next time he saw Alec, he would have to ask Alec himself about the secrets that lay between them. This was obviously something he and Alec had to work out on their own. "But I will say this about your Lightwood problem," Jace said very casually. "Isabel and Alec both have difficulty showing when they feel pain. But I can see it in both of them, especially when they try to hide it. She's in pain." "And I made it worse," Simon said, shaking his head. "This is my fault. Me, with my memory wiped out by some kind of demon king. Me, with no concept of what happened in my life for the last few years. Me, the guy with no special abilities, who's probably going to get killed in school. I'm a monster." "No," Jace said evenly. "You're all the things you just said. No one blames you for not being able to remember. You offered yourself as a sacrifice. You were brave. You saved Magnus, and you saved Isabel. You saved me. You need to bend your knees more." "What?" Jace was standing up now. "When you first step off, bend the knees right away. Otherwise, you did pretty well."
"But what about Isabel?" Simon asked. "What do I do?"
"I have no idea," Jace said.
"So you just came here to torture me and talk about yourself?" Simon demanded.
"Oh, Simon, Simon, Simon," said Jace. "You may not remember, but that's kind of our thing." With that, he walked away, clearly aware of the admiring glances that followed his every step. After lunch, they had a history lecture. Usually the two groups of students were divided for classes, but in certain cases, everyone was assembled together in the main hall. There was no grandeur to the hall, just some crooked benches and not enough of them, really. The chairs from the cafeteria were dragged in to supplement, but there still weren't enough seats. So some students, the elites, had chairs and benches, and the dregs sat on the floor at the front, like the little kids in middle school. After this morning, though, a few hours of sitting on a bare, cold stone floor was luxury. Katerina took her place at the wobbly lectern.
"We have a special guest lecturer today," she said. "She is visiting us to talk about the role Shadowhunters play in writing history. As you are likely aware, though I don't want to make any overly optimistic assumptions, Shadowhunters have been involved in many prominent moments in mundane history. Because Shadowhunters must also guard mundanes from knowing about our world, you must also sometimes take control of the writing of that history. By this, I mean you have to cover things up. You need to provide a plausible explanation for what's happened. One that does not involve demons."
"Like Men in Black?" Simon whispered to George.
"So please give your full attention to our esteemed guest," Katerina went on. She stepped aside, and a tall, young woman took her place.
"I am Tessa Gray," she said in a low, clear voice, "and I believe in the importance of stories."
This woman at the front of the room looked like she might be a sophomore in college. She was elegantly dressed in a short black skirt, cashmere sweater, and paisley scarf. Simon had seen this woman once before, at Jocelyn and Luke's wedding. Clary had said she had played a very important role in Clary's life when she was a child. She had also informed Simon that Tessa was about 250 years old, though she certainly didn't look it.
"For you to understand this story, you have to understand who and what I am. Like Katerina, I am a warlock. However, my mother was not human, but a shadowhunter."
A murmur from around the room, which Tessa glossed over.
"I am not able to bear marks, but I once lived among shadowhunters. I was a shadowhunter's wife, and my children were shadowhunters. I was witness to much that no other downworlder ever saw, and now I am almost the only person alive who recalls the truth behind the stories mundanes made up to explain away the times their world brushed ours. I am many things. One is a living record of shadowhunter history. Here is one story you may have heard of. Jack the Ripper. What can you tell me about that name?"
Simon was ready for this one. He'd read From Hell 6 times. He'd been waiting all his life for someone to ask him an Alan Moore question. His hands shot up.
"He was a murderer," Simon burst out. "He killed prostitutes in London in the late 1800s. He was probably Queen Victoria's doctor, and the whole thing was a royal cover-up to hide the fact that the prince had an illegitimate child."
Tessa smiled at him.
"You are right that Jack the Ripper is the name given to a murderer, or, at least, to a series of murders. What you refer to is the royal conspiracy, which has been disproven. I believe it is also the plot of a graphic novel and film called From Hell."
Simon's love life was complicated, but there was a pang, just for a moment, for this woman talking graphic novels with him.
Ah, well, Tessa Gray, foxy nerd, was probably dating someone already. "I will give you the simple facts," Tessa said. "Once I was not called Tessa Gray, but Tessa Herondale. In that time, in 1888 in East London, there was a string of terrible murders."
London, October 1888.
"It's not appropriate," Tessa said to her husband, Will. "He likes it."
"Children like all sorts of things, Will. They like sweets and fire and trying to stick their head up the chimney, just because he likes the dagger. Look how steadily he holds it."
Little James Herondale, age 2, was in fact holding a dagger quite well. He stabbed it into a sofa cushion, sending out a burst of feathers.
"Ducks,"
he said, pointing to the feathers. Tessa swiftly removed the dagger from his tiny hand and replaced it with a wooden spoon. James had recently become very attached to his wooden spoon and carried it with him everywhere, often refusing to go to sleep without it.
"Spoon,"
James said, tottering off across the parlour.
"Where did he find the dagger?" Tessa asked.
"It's possible I took him to the weapons room," Will said.
"Is it?"
"It is. Yes, it's possible."
"And it's possible he somehow got a dagger from where it is secured on the wall out of his reach," Tessa said.
"We live in a world of possibilities," Will said.
Tessa fixed a grey-eyed stare on her husband.
"He was never out of my sight," Will said quickly.
"If you could manage it," Tessa said, nodding to the sleeping figure of Lucy Herondale in her little basket by the fire. "Perhaps you won't give Lucy a broadsword until she's actually able to stand? Or is that asking too much?"
"It seems a reasonable request," Will said, with an extravagant bow.
Anything for you, my pearl beyond price. Even withholding weaponry from my only daughter. Will knelt down, and James ran to him to show off his spoon. Will admired the spoon as if it were a first edition, his scarred hand large and gentle against James's tiny back.
Spoon,
James said proudly.
I see, Jimmy Bach, murmured Will, who Tessa had caught singing Welsh lullabies to the children on their most sleepless nights. To his children, Will showed the same love he had always shown to her, fierce and unyielding, and the same protectiveness he had only ever showed to one other person, the person James had been named after. Will's parabatai, Jem.
Uncle Jem would be so impressed, she told Jamie with a smile. It was what she and Will called James Carstairs around their children, though between the two of them he was just Jem, and in public he was Brother Zachariah, a feared and respected silent brother.
Jem,
echoed James, quite clearly, and her smile grew. Will and James both tilted up their heads as one to look at her, their storm cloud black hair framing their faces. Jamie's was small and round, baby fat obscuring the bones and angles of a face that would one day be as like Will's as his hair. Two pairs of eyes, one darkly brilliant blue and one celestial gold, looked up at her with absolute trust and more than a little mischief, her boys. The long, long London summer days that Tessa was still getting used to, even after several years, were now starting to shorten rather rapidly. No more sunlight at 10 at night, now the night was gathering at 6 and the fog was heavy and faintly yellow, and it pressed against the windows. Bridget had drawn the curtains and the rooms were dim, but cozy. It was a strange thing, being a shadow hunter and a parent. She and Will had been living lives that constantly involved danger, and then suddenly, two very small children had joined them. Yes, they were two very small children who occasionally got hold of daggers and would one day start training to become warriors, if they wished to do so. But now they were simply two very small children. Little James, wobbling around the institute with his spoon. Little Lucy, napping in her cradle or basket or in one of many pairs of willing arms. These days Will was, Tessa was glad to note, a bit more careful about taking risks. Usually, she would really have to make sure there were no more daggers for the children. Bridget could usually keep the children well in hand, but Tessa and Will liked to be at home as much as they could. Cecily and Gabriel's little Anna was a year older than James, and had already blazed her way through the institute. She sometimes made attempts to go for walks on her own in London, but was always blocked by Auntie Jessamine, who stood guard by the door. Whether or not Anna knew that Auntie Jessamine was a ghost was unclear. She was simply the loving, ethereal force by the doorway who shooed her back inside and told her to stop taking her father's hats. It was a good life. There was a feeling of safety about it that reminded Tessa of a more peaceful time back when she was in New York, back before she knew all the truths about herself and the world she lived in. Sometimes, when she sat with her children by the fire, it all felt so normal. Like there were no demons, no creatures in the night. She allowed herself these moments.
"What are we having this evening?" Will asked, tucking the dagger into a drawer. "It smells a bit like lamb stew."
Before Tessa could answer, she heard the door open and Gabriel Lightwood came hurrying in, the smell of the cold fog trailing in his wake. He didn't bother to remove his coat. From the way he was walking and the look on his face, Tessa could tell that the little moment of domestic tranquility was over.
"Something wrong?" Will asked.
"This," Gabriel said. He held up a broadsheet newspaper called The Star.
"It's awful."
"I agree," Will said. "Those half-penny rags are terrible. But you seem to be more upset about them than is appropriate."
"They may be half-penny rags, but listen to this."
He stepped under a gaslight, unfolded the paper, and snapped it once to straighten it.
"The Terror of Whitechapel," he read.
"Oh," Will said, "that." Everyone in London knew about the terror in Whitechapel. The murders had been extraordinarily horrible. News of the killings now filled every paper. "Has walked again, and this time has marked down two victims, one hacked and disfigured beyond discovery, the other with her throat cut and torn. Again he has got away clear, and again the police, with wonderful frankness, confess that they have not a clue. They are waiting for a seventh and eighth murder,
just as they waited for a fifth to help them to it. Meanwhile, Whitechapel is half mad with fear. The people are afraid even to talk with a stranger. Notwithstanding the repeated proofs that the murderer has but one aim and seeks but one class in the community. The spirit of terror has got fairly abroad, and no one knows what steps a practically defenseless community may take to protect itself or avenge itself on any luckless wight who may be taken for the enemy. It is the duty of journalists to keep their heads cool and not inflame men's passions when what is wanted is cool temper and clear thinking. And we shall try to write calmly about this new atrocity.
Very lurid, said Will, but the East End is a violent place for mundanes.
I do not think this is a mundane. Wasn't there a letter?
The killer sent something.
Yes, a very odd letter.
I have that as well.
Gabriel went over to a desk in the corner and opened it, revealing a neat stack of newspaper cuttings.
Yes, here it is.
Dear boss, I keep on hearing the police have caught me, but they won't fix me just yet. I have laughed when they look so clever and talk about being on the right track. That joke about leather apron gave me real fits. I am down on whores and I shan't quit ripping them till I do get buckled. Grand work the last job was. I gave the lady no time to squeal. How can they catch me now? I love my work and want to start again. You will soon hear of me with my funny little games. I saved some of the proper red stuff in a ginger beer bottle over the last job to write with, but it went thick like glue and I can't use it. Red ink is fit enough, I hope. Ha ha. The next job I do, I shall clip the lady's ears off and send to the police officers just for a jolly, wouldn't you? Keep this letter back till I do a bit more work, then give it out straight. My knife's so nice and sharp, I want to get to work right away if I get a chance. Good luck. Yours truly, Jack the Ripper.
That's quite a name he's given himself, Tessa said, and quite horrific.
And almost certainly false, Gabriel said. A bit of nonsense made up by newspapermen to keep selling the story, and good for us as well, as it gives a human face, or at least the appearance of a human hand to it. But come, I'll show you.
He waved them over to a table in the middle of the room and removed a map from inside his coat. He spread this out.
I have just come from the East End, he said. Something about the stories disturbed me for more than the obvious reasons. I went there to have a look about for myself, and what happened last night proves my theory. There have been many murders recently, all of women.
Women who...
Prostitutes, Tessa said. Quite, Gabriel said. Tessa has such an extensive vocabulary, Will said. It's one of the most attractive things about her.
Shame about yours, Gabriel.
Will, listen to me.
Gabriel allowed himself a long sigh.
Spoon,
James said, running at his Uncle Gabriel and jabbing him in the thigh. Gabriel mussed the boy's hair affectionately.
You're such a good boy, he said. I often wonder how you could possibly be Will's.
Spoon,
James said, leaning against his uncle's leg lovingly.
No, Jamie, Will urged. Your honourable father has been impugned. Attack! Attack!
Bridget, Tessa said, could you take James to have his supper? James was ushered from the room, caught up in Bridget's skirts.
The first murder, Gabriel said, was here. Bucks Row, that occurred on August 31st, very vicious, with a number of long cuts to the abdomen. The second was on Hanbury Street on September 8th. Her name was Annie Chapman, and she was found in the courtyard behind a house. This murder had a very similar set of incisions, but was very much worse. The contents of the abdomen were simply removed. Some organs were placed on her shoulder, some organs were simply gone. All of the work was done with a surgical precision and would have taken a skilled surgeon some time to do. This was done in minutes, outdoors, without much light to work by. This was the work that got my attention, and now the last murders, which were only a few nights ago, these were fiendish works indeed. Now, observe closely, the first murder of that night took place here. He pointed to a spot on the map marked Dutfield's Yard. This is right off Burner Street, you see. This was Elizabeth Stride, and she was found at 1 in the morning. Similar injuries, but seemingly incomplete.
Just 45 minutes later, the body of Catherine Eddowes is found in Mitre Square. Gabriel traced his finger along the route from Berners Street to Mitre Square. It's a distance over half a mile, he said. I've just walked it several times. The route of the killer is known because a bit of Elizabeth Stride's apron was found here in